Thank you very much for attending the session. My name is Sean Pillay. I'm a Premier Field Engineer based in Microsoft Denmark. Jeg taler dansk, men det er ikke godt nok, så vi tager det bare på engelsk. This morning's session, first of all, before we go ahead, I'd like to talk to you briefly about how many of your Premier customers here? Just a handful. Okay, so for anyone who's not a Premier customer, what I do, I mentioned I'm a Premier Field Engineer. A Premier customer is someone who enters into an agreement with Microsoft where you purchase a number of support hours that you use for support. This is broken down into two categories, namely proactive support and reactive support. Okay, proactive support is, for example, if you'd like to have a health check done on your Active Directory, or if you'd like to attend a workshop perhaps, you do that using your proactive hours. And obviously reactive hours are if there is a problem, for example, an Exchange server goes down, or any replications broke, for example, you'd use up your reactive hours. Okay, so during this time for the proactive and reactive offerings, a PFE or Premier Field Engineer is deployed on site. Okay, that would be myself. I work as part of a group of about, I think it's 15 or 16 people that do the same thing. Okay, so moving on. I'm originally from the UK, by the way, just in case you're wondering about my non-Danish speaking English accent. I couldn't get enough of your bacon, so I decided to move over. Only to find out that the good bits are shipped across. Okay, so Active Directory, Domain Services, and Windows Azure Virtual Machines. Right, so how many of you are using virtual domain controllers in Azure at the moment? Wow, that's impressive. Okay, good. Any issues so far? Okay, so basically the feature's been released just about 6 months ago, I think, went RTA. Lots of feedback from the field on it. Lots of people asking questions. So I thought to put together this session to enlighten you on basically what this is all about. Okay, so the agenda for today: why are we even discussing Active Directory? Why? It's we all know how to DC promo, right? So why are we even discussing this? But when you're running a domain controller in Windows Azure virtual network, it's slightly different to how you deploy a domain controller on premise. Okay, so we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about some Windows Azure terminology. Okay, so some terms that are not used on a daily basis. Some terms that you need to familiarize yourself with going forward. We're going to look at some deployment scenarios and decisions. Okay, when you deploy a replica DC, for example, when would you deploy a new forest, for example, perhaps a mix of both. Okay, and lastly, we're going to close off with a few general considerations. Okay, what are the things that we need to bear in mind when we deploy these domain controllers? Okay, so some objectives. As we said, we're going to talk about the notion of deploying ADDS on Windows Azure Virtual Machines. We're going to shed some light on the areas of Windows Azure that are not very well known at the moment. So virtual networks, perhaps virtual networks, and connectivity to domain controllers from your on-site. Okay, so off-premises. We're going to look at various different scenarios that you're not used to on a day-to-day base. Okay, emphasize how to optimize for cost and performance. Okay, so we're going to talk about that as well. And highlight the technical considerations for various deployment scenarios. Okie doke. First, a point of clarification. Is what we're talking about here Windows Azure AD? And the answer is no. This is not Windows Azure AD. This is running a bog standard virtual domain controller in the Windows Azure Fabric. Okay, so just like your normal DC that you run on Hyper-V or ESX, running that in a separate off-site data center. So Windows Azure AD is something totally different. Okay, as we said, it's totally different to what we're talking about. It's a Windows Azure AD, just to give you a brief primer, and I've also dropped in another slide in there just to give you a brief overview of what it is. Windows Azure AD is a cloud version of the Active Directory. Okay, so it provides identity and access to your services without a central store. Okay, so that's the primary difference between the two, because we federate these days, don't we? If we had to have a central store in the cloud, we'd need a username and password for every single cloud user in the world. which is not really going to happen. Okay. So primary differences I put together for you. So hosted on-premises, so Windows, Azure, Active Directory, and Windows Active Directory to your left and right. So hosted on-premises or in the cloud, that's as of 6 months ago. Okay. Windows Azure AD hosted in the cloud only, i.e. in our data centers. Okay. You manage your infrastructure and data, so with Windows Active Directory on site. We manage the infrastructure, you manage the data, so in the cloud version. Okay, so it just takes an additional layer of work away from yourselves. Services, the two main concepts that we're going to compare here is authentication and authorization. So on-site, we use Kerberos and NTLM, as we did traditionally. Okay. Key difference between the two, again, as I said, is a central store. Kerberos and NTLM, we use a central store. Services, with Windows Azure AD, we use Federated Authentication, WS Federation, and SAML. Okay, so for those of you who don't know, Federated Authentication is a technology that allows us to forward credentials. So it's like it's kind of like a trust, an Active Directory trust, but on steroids. Okay, so slightly advanced, allows you to do more things. WS Federation is an industry standard that defines how these credentials or what the data structure is of these bits of information that's sent across the wire, encompassing authentication and authorization data. Okay. SAML is actually WS Federation. Beg your pardon. SAML is the industry standard, and WS Federation is another version of the industry standard, built together by Microsoft, IBM, and a few other companies. So it's the other way around. For more information, you can see Ulrich Bearholm's session from yesterday, which is AZ302, if you're interested. Okay, so why are we even discussing Active Directory? So before we even go to that point, let's talk about virtual machines running on-site and virtual machines running in the cloud. Okay, so why should I even run a virtual machine in Windows Azure? Okay, so I've just put together five bullet points. First of all, cost. Okay, significantly cheaper than on-premise hosting. So it's a pay-as-you-go infrastructure. Okay, so you don't have to worry about hardware. What's the cost of a HP DL380G, what is it these days, G7, okay, server plus a support contract for a year, 24/7. When I was a customer about 4 years ago, that was about £12,000. Okay, so I don't know what the equivalent is in Denmark, but it's very expensive just for one server. Okay, whereas if you're hosting this in a data center, you do not have to pay for the infrastructure, you do not have to pay for power and all the sort of bits and bobs that are required to host this server. Okay, so a huge cost saving. High availability, 99.9% uptime. Okay, so that's high uptime. Okay, so we we know that it's quite a challenge to have that in your traditional data center because we've got all sorts of issues going on, and you can never guarantee a high uptime. Okay, so highly available. So we've got Windows Azure is geographically dispersed, so it's a massive, giant fabric. It's like a 1 million node Hyper-V cluster, geographically dispersed. Okay, so high availability, security. Okay, secure Microsoft data centers. Now, with the recent spate of events, I thought I'd drop this anyway. We will not disclose customer data to a third party, including law enforcement, government entity, or civil litigant, except as directed by you or required by law. Okay, so that's our statement on there. So just in case you're thinking, why should I put my data in the cloud? Okay, so who's going to be prying on it? Will other people have access to it? That's our statement on it. Okay. Scalability, so resources available on the fly. As of last week, thanks to Craig Forster. Craig, if you're here, no, you're not. 1 million servers in Windows Azure. 1 million servers in Windows Azure, each with 48 cores and 96 gigabytes of RAM. This will be 5 million by 2017. Just to give you an idea of the stats we're talking about there. So that's about 48 million cores. That's a lot. Okay, that's quite a lot. So you can scale out on the fly. You don't have to worry about balancing your virtual servers. How many nodes? How many guest servers do we have on the CSX cluster? I need to check. okay, we're out of resources there, we can't build the VM on there, we'll have to build it on this box. So all of that sort of admin tasks are taken away from you. Okay, so this is clearly taken care of by Windows Azure. Scale out on the fly, no additional work required. Flexibility, so the best of both worlds. I put this in, I quite like this. So you can have your infrastructure in the cloud and you can have your infrastructure on site. Okay, so you get the best of both worlds. Obviously, you could, if you choose to, at one point in time, to move all your servers to the cloud. Okay, or as most customers do, have a hybrid setup. Okay, so you've got half in the cloud and half on site. Okay, so it's flexible. From a management perspective, the underlying hardware and the hypervisor is managed by us. So as well, so another huge benefit. So none of this is one less thing for you to worry about, so that you can focus on your day-to-day tasks instead of being concerned with issues such as this. Okay. So those are putting virtual machines in Windows Azure. Okay. Huge benefit. What are some of the business drivers? So why are we discussing Active Directory? What are some of the business drivers? Why would I want to put a domain controller in the cloud? Okay, so I put together a few points there. A support prerequisite for other applications or services. For example, if I wanted to deploy a SharePoint server or a SharePoint farm in the cloud, I need some sort of authentication mechanism, don't I? Because SharePoint, well, you could get SharePoint to work without a DC, but it's not very easy. But for all intents and purposes, you would require a domain controller out there. Okay, for authentication. To serve as a substitute or failover site. So how many of you have disaster recovery sites? Okay, that's about 5% of the room. Okay, mind you, there's only about 10 of you here anyway. But there's about 5% of the room. So not a lot. Okay, not a lot. So there's some thought, some consideration has gone into here. Is that what happens if our main data center blows up or goes up in smoke? Okay. What's the plan B? Do we get the tapes out? Okay. How do we recover? Or do we have a disaster recovery site that we continuously replicate to using some sort of SAN replication for our data, and we've got a couple of DCs out there? At which point in time, if the hub site does blow up, hopefully not, we are able to keep business running without any downtime. Okay, so a disaster recovery site, as mentioned, for physical outage, for physical disasters on your main hub site, or you could choose to have it as a failover site, for example. Okay, to serve as an authentication mechanism for a cloud-only data center. So third point, as I said earlier on, if you had to move all your servers into the cloud, you're going to need some sort of authentication mechanism. Okay, so that's a no-brainer. Remote branch of a site with no IT presence or infrastructure. This is probably going to be one of the biggest sellers. So how many of you out there have remote sites with no IT presence, people coming across the WAN with their round trip time measured in days? 3 people. Okay. That's a huge benefit. Okay, so we've got Azure data centers deployed across the world now. So you've got Western Europe, Northern Europe, you've got Asia Pac, you've got Americas. So whichever part of the world you're in, there is a data center that is close by to you. Okay, so you could quite easily deploy a domain controller out there, configure Active Directory sites and services, subnets, link in the sites to the relevant site, the subnet to the relevant site, and allow clients to connect. Okay. This will obviously improve their performance, their login performance, their overall performance. If they're using Exchange, they're coming across the WAN, it's going to be a lot quicker. Okay, so more productive. Management of cloud VMs, example GPOs. Okay, so I put in a bunch of servers in the cloud, and I need to manage them all. Okay, so I could go around and manage them each individually, which is not very productive, and it's going to take me a long time. Or I can deploy a domain controller out there and use group policies. Okay, use group policies to manage, to centrally manage these servers. Okay. Or I put the last point in there, the new management console, which is something I quite like, is the ability to pool my Windows Server 2012 servers. Okay, so if you want to manage your server centrally from the central management console. Okay. From the design aspect, I thought I'll throw this in there. The 80s topology should be optimally defined. Okay, so it's not just a DC promo. By optimally defined, I mean sites and subnets and site links should be optimally defined. Okay, because we want to try to reduce the amount of egress traffic from the Windows Azure network. Does anybody know why? Okay, you are charged for any traffic leaving the Windows Azure network. So there are two charges. There's an hourly charge for a gateway that you pay. Okay, I think that works out to about $37 a month or something of that sort. And then there is a charge for the data that you send out. Okay, so there are two charges. So what you want to try to do is obviously try and keep what's coming out of Windows Azure as low as possible. Okay. By the way, the first 5 gig is free. Okay, so depending on how much replication goes on, you can obviously look to save costs. Make sure the Active Directory topology is defined correctly. As I said, I work as a field engineer. I do lots of health checks. I've seen hundreds of Active Directory environments, DNS environments, and I can tell you every single one of them had Active Directory sites and subnets misconfigured, and it's one of the textbook scenarios. Okay, textbook scenarios. Create the subnets, link them into the site. If you're deploying a DC in Azure and you don't do that, obviously the impact will be that you're going to be paying a bit more. Okay, placing Active Directory DCs in Windows Azure equates to running virtual domain controllers. Who's not running a virtual DC? One? No? Okay. So the concern with that, we'll talk about later on, was obviously snapshotting and so on. The hypervisor for Windows Azure does now include support for VM GenID. Okay, so you can snapshot, you can clone just like you do, but only with Windows Server 2012 or 2012 R2. So prior to that, snapshotting and cloning will not work, so it's not a good idea to do that. Okay, so just some useful notes for you to know is that the hypervisor does include support for that. Okay, so moving on to Windows Azure terminology. Okay, so Windows Azure Virtual Machines, I put this in there because there seems to be some confusion going on with a Windows Azure Virtual Machine and the VM role. Okay, there is a clear, distinct definition of the two service offerings. Okay, the VM role is a PaaS offering, Platform as a Service, where we provide you with hardware and the OS, and off you go. A VM is clearly the bare bones machine. Okay, so apparently, in terms of terminology, uppercase V M defines a virtual machine. Okay, a lowercase VM defines the VM role. So useful trivia for you to know. Windows Azure Virtual Network. Okay, so those of you running DCs in Azure are familiar with this. The virtual network is effectively your LAN in the cloud. Okay, so you create a Windows Azure Virtual Network. So you create a LAN in the cloud, effectively, and you connect that to your on-premise. Straightforward. Okay, so in terms of connectivity from on-site to the cloud, there's full connectivity without any issues. Virtual IP address, okay, a VIP, is a new concept that's come out with Windows Azure, or been released with that, and that's basically an IP address that has not been assigned to any network interface or MAC address. Okay, so it's an IP address that's been assigned to a group of services. Okay, so if I had perhaps a virtual network that we just talked about, created that LAN in the cloud, at the front of that I would have a VIP or a virtual IP address. So when I connect from my on-premise into the cloud, I will connect to the VIP, and then the VIP will redirect my traffic to my virtual machines. Okay, so that's the concept of it. It's an internet-facing IP address. It is not bound to a specific computer or MAC address or interface. Dynamic IP addresses. Okay, so it's not as obvious as we think. Yes, it is dynamically assigned by a DHCP server, but the concepts are slightly different. in that the primary difference is that this IP address will stay with the virtual machine for the duration of its life. Okay, so no matter what you do to that virtual machine, it will always have that IP address. Okay, so that's contrary to what we are used to with the on-site DHCP. So it's kind of like a DHCP with a lifetime reservation, if you like. Okay, these are used on virtual machines in Windows Azure. Okay, all virtual machines or all VMs in Windows Azure use dynamic IP addresses. Okay, do not configure them with static IP addresses. They will not work. And I'll tell you why a little bit later on. Okay, the IP address persists with the same virtual machine for the entire lifetime, as we said. Service healing. Service healing, okay, it's not something that we particularly like to talk about, but I think it's important that we do mention it. So what happens when things go wrong? Okay, is there a plan B? Okay, is my parachute going to work when I jump out? Service healing is a feature, is a Windows Azure feature that automatically restores a VM to its previous running state on detecting that there are issues or there were issues with a service, with a device, for example, the switch at the top of the rack, a node in the rack of servers, it could be anything, a system board, it could be anything. The minute we detect that this is the case, we restore the VM to a new node or to a new area where there's optimal resources. This is all handled or managed by the Windows Azure Fabric Controller. Okay, so this is all done automatically. So we've got a few instances of the Fabric Controller running in each rack of servers, and that keeps an eye on things. Okay, we use something called probing, which we'll talk about a little bit later. To give you an idea of what it is that, for example, Windows Azure needs some sort of mechanism to find out if these machines are up and running. So obviously, it's not going to go ahead and check if AD replication is working okay, or if DNS is working okay. It's going to give us an idea of whether or not the machine is up and running. Okay, and we do that by using TCP probes. And there are some other tools that we use. But TCP probes, so we would probe the machine doing a three-way handshake, so a SYNAC. Excuse me. So we do a SYNAC, and we get a reply on that. And as far as we're concerned, or Azure is concerned, the machine is up. But as I said, it will not tell you if Active Directory is working. It will not tell you if Exchange is functioning. The core OS is what we're concerned about. And as long as that's up and running, we deem the machine as up and running okay. Okay. Such an event is perceived by Active Directory as an unplanned reboot. Okay, so if we do have to have this service healing process, or something does go wrong, to the Active Directory, it's seen as the DC was rebooted. Okay, no big deal. We all reboot DCs. Okay, so it's no real impact on it. What effect does service healing have on domain controllers then? Okay, so the MAC address of the domain controller will change. Okay, so that will certainly change. It's moved over to a new host. The CPU ID of the VM will also change. Okay. The IP address of the VM will not change. So if the IP address of the VM changed, then we got some serious problems. Okay. So if you looked at MAC address, if you look at CPUs, these are things that don't really have an impact on what we have to do for our day-to-day tasks. But if the IP address changed, then we got some problems. Okay. It requires that the VM is deployed on Windows Azure Virtual Network. Important note, so when you deploy your VMs, make sure that you deploy them on a Windows Azure Virtual Network. And what I mean by that is make sure that there is a network up. So you have the option to deploy a VM in Windows Azure without a network. So you could just deploy a workgroup, for example, with just a server in there. Okay, in order for you to benefit from this feature, you need to make sure that you're on the Windows Azure Virtual Network. Rights to the Active Directory DITS log sysfol will not be lost. Okay, this is very important, because if we do have loss to Active Directory logs and sysfol and so on, what's going to happen? You're going to have data loss. Okay, so that's not a good thing. Okay, the reason why this will not be lost is because we specify data disks when we build this DC. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Do the preceding behaviors affect Active Directory, as we said? So from a domain controller's perspective, no dependency on the MAC address or CPU, so it works fine. Absolutely no issues. Ensure that writes to the Active Directory databases are durable. Okay, so there are two types of disks. Excuse me. OS disks. Excuse me. OS disks and data disks. Okay. Primary difference between the two is that OS disks cache data before they write it to the disk. Data disks do not cache data. By not caching data, I mean they use a force unit access. Okay, so the force unit access, if we dig into this a bit deeper, is a SCSI command that says send the write to the disk. Don't buffer it, send it directly to the disk. Okay, no data loss. Affinity groups and availability sets. So I've seen this, there's lots of discussion going around about these two points. There's a bit of confusion on it. So I thought I'll drop this in there as well. So an affinity group is a group of resources that are grouped in the same location, okay, for performance reasons. Say, for example, you deploy a VM in Copenhagen, but the storage is in the US. So that's not going to be very good for writes or performance on that box. You would like to have the member server here or the server here and the storage in the same data center, in the same container, preferably. Okay, for performance reasons, so that there's no latency between reads and writes. Availability sets is something that's used for high availability. High availability meaning that spread the load across a number of different racks. Excuse me. So in Windows Azure, we have various racks of servers. Okay, if you're deploying more than one server, and I hope you deploy more than one in the case of domain controllers, well, it's a best practice anyway. You deploy a single DC into the Azure network or virtual network, which will be hosted on or in a particular rack. Okay, deploying your second DC, configure an availability set. By doing that, you would deploy the second DC in another rack. Okay, so meaning that if this rack did fail for whatever reason, you still have a domain controller that's fully functional. Okay, that's an availability set. So make sure you spread the load, or you don't have a single point of failure. Let's put it to you that way. Okay. Excuse me. Okay. So moving on to deployment scenarios and decisions then. Okay, so when will I, what sort of DC do I need to deploy? Do I need to deploy a replica? Do I need to deploy a new forest? What should I go for? Okay, so I've broken this down into three different categories that seem to be the most popular. Do I go for hybrid, cloud only, or both? Okay, so various different choices that we need to make on there. A hybrid scenario is when you deploy a domain controller that is a replica of your existing domain into the cloud. Okay, so if we look at the diagram, excuse me, the corp site on the right and the Windows Azure site on the left. Okay, so you've deployed a domain controller in Windows Azure, which is a replica of your domain controller that you have on site. Considerations that we need to think about. Excuse me. Do applications need access to corporate directory data? So we're talking about cloud. There's going to be lots of talk about applications. There's going to be lots of talk about services. It's all about the requirements of these applications and services. If they could quite happily get away with using Kerberos and NTLM, absolutely. Replica DC or central store, whichever way you look at it. It all depends on the application dependency. Okay. Do the applications need to authenticate users from a local directory or an on-site directory? In which case, we need to deploy a replica DC because we need to have a copy of our data or copy of our user database in the cloud. Excuse me. So it's a bit dry. Hybrid deployments. Okay, seem to be the most common these days, depending on obviously what you're deploying. But this is what customers are generally going for at the moment, based on the needs of their business and application requirements. Cloud-only deployment. Okay, so new forest in the cloud. Okay, I would like to create a test environment, for example. I could quite easily take a copy of my domain controllers out there, deployed in an isolated environment. Using Windows Server 2012, you could clone, you can make copies. If you want to have a test bed, okay, so you don't need the infrastructure, you don't have to go to the powers that be to ask for new hardware or all that sort of stuff. Or if you've got an Azure membership or Azure subscription, you've got unlimited resources, you can have your test lab on the fly. Okay, so you can clone your DCs, deploy them into this area, isolated, so new forest, okay, totally isolated from the corporate network. Support cloud-only applications and services. If I have an application or service that is cloud-only, I do not want any connectivity back to the corp network. I want to keep it isolated. Okay, that's another scenario. Okay, so a couple of things to bear in mind. Again, it all comes down to what the application requirements are. Okay, hybrid and cloud. Hybrid and cloud. Hybrid and cloud, replica DC, and you have a new forest in the cloud. So a bit of both. Okay, so the best of both worlds. So perhaps you need to have you've deployed a SharePoint environment in the cloud, and that SharePoint environment does also require to authenticate users on site. Okay, in which case you deploy a DC. Cloud applications need access to corporate directory and to be isolated from the corporate network. Okay, so I want to authenticate users and I want to be isolated. Okay, so perhaps a new forest in the cloud in addition to your existing forest, and a trust perhaps, or federation between the two, depending on what the application supports. Okay, cloud-only applications need to authenticate users from the corporate directory. Okay, so that's a straightforward scenario. A couple of things I've thrown in there as well to add to that: network topology. The extension of the Azure Virtual Network requires a VPN endpoint. Now, depending on your network infrastructure, you might need to buy a VPN device, but most organizations these days, that's not a problem. Your device needs to support site-to-site VPN tunneling. Okay, if it does not support that, it won't work. I know I tried to get that working at home and it failed miserably until I had to buy a new device. And my boss is sitting and smiling at the back there. So thank you very much. Virtual DCs have a 14 gig RAM limit. Okay, so something to bear in mind. This is a limit on them for now. Okay, a single network adapter. I've seen a few customers using network adapters for a backup environment or backup network. So you have your DC on one LAN, and then you have a separate, so multi-home DC, two network adapters on the same box, and you use the second network adapter for a backup, for the actual backup of the domain controller. So not as a backup LAN, but to actually carry the backup data across on a separate network. So if you're looking to do things like that, then obviously bear that in mind. Backup and restore. Create system state backups. Okay, so important. When you deploy domain controllers out there in the cloud, please configure backups. So once the domain controller is deployed, yes, fantastic, great stuff. Let's configure a backup of it. Treat it like a normal DC. Okay, treat it like a normal DC. Use availability sets for multiple DCs. Do not snapshot or copy VHDs. So if you're running Server 2012, this is absolutely fine. There's no issues with doing that. If you're not running Server 2012, don't do it, because you're going to cause issues in your environment, such as USN rollback. General considerations. Okay, so what are the things that we need to consider? Is it safe to virtualize DCs? We'll have a chat about that. Placement of the Active Directory database. Optimizing your deployment for traffic and cost. Read-only domain controllers. Okay, reads, writes. GC or not. Trust or replicate. Okay, we talked about that briefly. Should I create a trust between the two forests, or should I replicate? IP addressing and name resolution and a geo-distributed cloud-hosted domain controller. Okay, let's do some background on virtual domain controllers. Okay, so about 8 years ago, we released... About 8 years ago, the notion of a virtual domain controller became very popular. Okay, so we deployed a domain controller, as you normally do, and it worked fine. No issues, it's just like any other server. Until hypervisor vendors decided to add in a new feature that allowed us to snapshot. That's when things went horribly wrong. Not because of they've introduced the feature, but because we were able to snapshot a domain controller at a particular point in time and then restore that DC or roll it back using that snapshot back to a particular point of time without telling the domain controller that it's been restored from a snapshot or without telling the domain controller it's been rolled back. As a result, it does not know of this. Okay, you've rolled it back in time. To the domain controller itself, this has no impact. It works fine. People authenticate, resolve DNS, and so on and so forth, with no issues. Excuse me. To other DCs, that's when the problem comes in, is that they don't know that this domain controller has been rolled back in time. And you'll see what I mean in the next slide. With Active Directory, this USN rollback can lead to various issues in your environment. Lingering objects, for one. How many of you had to deal with lingering objects? One, two, three. Okay. Three people. Lingering objects are basically an inconsistency in the Active Directory database between two domain controllers. A John Smith exists on that DC, but he does not exist on the other DC. Okay. If John Smith was a schema admin, what do we do then? He's got full control of your schema. Okay, so not good. Inconsistent passwords. If John Smith set his account on DC A and to cat, and on DC B that's been rolled back, it's his old password of password 1, he's not going to be able to log in. So issues. Okay, schema mismatches. We've had this. There's been a restore of a virtual domain controller that held a schema master role. Okay, so we had schema mismatches. The potential also exists for duplicate SIDs. Okay, if I have a duplicate SID, what does that mean? Both those accounts are equivalent. So if I had the Active Directory Enterprise Administrator with a SID of A, and if I had someone with a lower level of access with the same SID, they effectively both have the same permission. So anywhere on the network that SID has been specified, i.e. if it's been specified in some share on a file server or to someone's mailbox, the person with lower privileges has full access. Okay, so duplicate SIDs are a bad thing. Okay, USN rollbacks we talked about. I put this slide in there just to give you a brief, or just to give you a better understanding for those of you who... How many of you had to deal with the USN rollbacks? One, two, three, okay. Three people. So for the others who haven't had to deal with it, good, okay. It shows that obviously you're running virtual domain controllers and you're following Microsoft's best practices. No issues. Two domain controllers, DC1 and DC2. I create a snapshot at time T1, okay. So there's three relevant bits of information on the right-hand side. I have a USN, I have an ID, and I have a RID pool. A USN is an update sequence number. An update sequence number is a counter that exists. It's a 64-bit counter that exists on all domain controllers that is used to keep track of the writes that are made to that Active Directory locally. Okay, so it's a 64-bit counter. Whenever there's a write that's made to the database, it goes up by one. So it starts by one, two, three, four, so on and so forth. Invocation ID of A or ID. Okay, the ID stands for invocation ID. Invocation ID is a unique identifier for that instance of the Active Directory database that is running on that DC. If you restore a domain controller, the invocation ID changes. That's how the domain controller knows that it has a new instance of the Active Directory. Excuse me. That's where it all goes horribly wrong when using a snapshot, is that ID of A is not given a new ID. Okay, the new features in Server 2012, we give it a new ID. Okay, when you snapshot, it automatically detects that and it's given a new ID. The root pool, okay, the root pool is a group of numbers that are used when security principles are created. So users, computers, groups, and so on. You all know what a SID is. The portion, the end portion of the SID, the hyphen short number, okay, is a number that is extracted from the root pool. Okay, so by default, 500. Every DC has a root pool of 500. When that depletes to 250, it contacts the root master and says, "Hi, I'm down to 250. Can I have a new pool, please?" It's kind of like a different version of DHCP, if you like, lease renewal. So we've got a pool of 500. So 500 to 1,000. So we've got 500 RIDs available to be used on this DC. We then take a snapshot at time T1. Following that, we add 100 users. So as we said, the USN counter, we've made 100 writes. So that should go up to 100, or go up by 100, giving us a total of 200. Okay, so we're all there. Excuse me. All on the same page. The invocation ID still stays the same. We haven't restored the DC. We haven't DC permitted down. The root pool, that depletes by 100. So now we've got 600 to 1,000. Okay. We then notify DC2 of the changes. It says, DC2, I've got some changes. DC2 says, yes, sure. Send them across. DC2 keeps a record. Okay. Let's go back a bit. Get this pointer to work. DC2 keeps the record on the other side, noting the USN number of DC1. So I know that the last time I replicated with you, you were at a USN number of 200. Okay? 200 with an invocation ID of A. So the database ID of A. Okay, so I know invocation ID A, and the last time I replicated with you was 200. Important. Next step. Snapshot applied. So DC1 blows up, and we have hypervisor administrator, we'll call it, or him or her, who restores the snapshot. Okay, thinking that I've taken a snapshot earlier on, DC went down, let me restore it. It's going to work, right? To the untrained eye, it might work. It will work. So people will authenticate. That's the problem. You won't know. You're in USN rollback. Event ID 2095. Okay, that's flagged in the event log. You will know if you check AD replication. How many of you run REPL some every 5-10 minutes or every half an hour? Not many people. Okay, so things just remain as they are. People work. But you don't know replication is broken between these two boxes. Anyway, snapshots applied. And let's look at the values. So we have a USN of 100, which was the value earlier on. Absolutely fine. Invocation ID of A and a root pool of 500 to 1,000. Excuse me. On DC2 on the other side, what are the records saying? Invocation ID of A and a USN value of 200. So I'm saying that the value I have for you, for your invocation ID of A, is 200. Okay, so this is interesting because now our state of play says our USN value is 100. Okay, so I've been rolled back into a point in time. DC2 does not know about this. I then go ahead and I add 150 more users. Okay, so that takes the USN value up to 250. So 100 plus 150 for that, because there's 150 writes, it takes it up to 250. Okay, invocation ID and the root pool goes up to 650. DC2 is then notified of the changes. Hi, I have some changes. DC2 then says, righty, the last time I have replicated with you, I had a value of 200. Now, your value is 250. So, what does that mean to me? That means to me that I'm missing 50 changes. Technically, that's right, right? But actually, am I missing 50 changes? No, I'm missing 150 changes, ladies and gentlemen. Because of this, only 50 users will replicate across. You've now got a complete inconsistency between these two domain controllers. Excuse me. Okay. This is USN rollback explained at a very high level. So if you roll back the DC in time, its partner doesn't know about it, those two DCs will not replicate any values before that. Okay, server 2012, what we've done is something totally different. We do a check every time the machine starts up. There is a 128-bit unique identifier that is exposed by the hypervisor to the VM, which is stored in the Active Directory. This value is then checked. It's stored on the computer account of the domain controller. This value is then checked against the hypervisor value, and if they match, it means that the DC was as the same state it was when it was shut down. If they don't match, it means that I've been moved to another hypervisor. As a result, it resets the invocation ID, of A. It gives it a new ID and brings it up again. When it brings it up again, its partner then notices and says, "Ah, I don't have an invocation ID of A anymore. I've now got an invocation ID of B. Let me add this to my table and set up a new set of entries for this. Can you send me all changes across, please?" As a result, you will converge those two DCs. It's quite clever. Okay, virtualization conclusions. Use only Windows Azure Virtual Machines. So we've got the PaaS option, which is a web role and worker role, which you don't really want to use. Technically, they work, but the difference between this is that the web roles and worker roles hydrate instances on the fly when something goes wrong, which you don't really want to. You want to be in control of your Active Directory. Use virtual machines. So use the infrastructure as a service. Excuse me. Virtual machines. Disk writes are durable and designed for these workloads. So as we said earlier on as well, is to make sure that you use data disks. Okay, so they're designed specifically for this. Do not sysprep DCs. How many of you tried to sysprep a DC and has the courage to put your hand up? Did it work? Yeah? The sysprep tool will not allow you to do that. Okay. Sysprep tool will not allow you to do that. So good luck. To get a DC in Azure, you could PTV a physical box. Bit of an overkill. You could use DC promo, right? Okay. You could PTV, physical to virtual, for anyone who doesn't know. It's basically taking a physical box and converting it into a virtual box and putting it up in the cloud. Okay, bit of an overkill. Move an existing virtual DC VHD file. So, yeah, you could do that. So shut down an on-site DC. Take the VHD file, move that to Azure. So it's effectively moving the DC. Make sure to update sites and subnets, site links and so on. You could build a new Windows Server instance and replicate DC promo, the new box. Okay, so this is probably the quick and clean and easy way to get out of this. IFM, install from media, a feature that's there, but it's not very often. It's not very often that it's used. Okay, install from media, so it allows you to back up a domain controller, system state, move that across to the member server that you're going to DC promo, restore those files into a location, then DC promo up that member server, using those files as a source. So I don't go across the WAN to build that DC as you normally do. I have the source files, or the Active Directory build files, locally, build them up, once it's up to a certain level, it then replicates the balance or the changes that it needs. Okay, so IFM, excuse me, especially in Windows Azure, because you'd like to keep the egress traffic down to a minimum. Okie doke, placement of the Active Directory DIT. Okay, so the Active Directory DIT, as we said, should be placed on data disks, okay, not on OS disks. By default, when you build a virtual machine in Windows Azure, the operating system is installed on an OS disk. Okay, so you need to add in a second disk. You can do that via the Windows Azure console. It's very straightforward. The user interface is absolutely fantastic. Very intuitive, very easy to use. Add in a new disk, attach that to the member server, and then DC promo. And then during your DC promo, when you have your options of where to install sysfall, so don't just choose the defaults of /Windows sysfall, so on, move that to the new disk. Because if you do that, choose the default option, it's going to be installed on the OS disks. If it's installed on the OS disk, you have write buffer. Okay, so you have data that's buffered before it's written to the disk. Bad news, you don't want to do that. Okay, largest disk size is a terabyte. Okay, so the largest disk size is a terabyte that you can attach. And the largest known Active Directory database is just over a terabyte. It's quite large. Okay, why is this a concern? As we said, forced units access earlier on, it's a SCSI command that says effectively write the data to the disk now, don't cache it. Okay, I want it sent to persistent media at this point in time of the write. Okay, can introduce USM bubbles. That's a good one. So if you have OS disks, for example, and you've got a cache that you're using, that you're writing to, you potentially could lose that data, okay, and you roll back to a state in time, because as far as Active Directory knows, at that point in time, those items weren't written or weren't committed. So you could roll yourself back, so mini USM rollback. Okay, important to note, optimizing your deployment for traffic and costs. Okay, consider costs and deploy configure accordingly. So you want to try to limit your egress traffic, okay, keep that down to a minimum. Okay, so there's various different things that need to take into consideration here. I mean, really, how much of data would you replicate out using AD replication? Suppose it would depend on the number of objects you have, okay, how often those objects are changed. If you're adding new objects on a daily basis by some application, then that could be high. But if you have a fairly static AD, and Active Directory uses linked value replication anyway, so only the changes are getting replicated. Okay, so try and monitor that and see how much of data you're replicating out. As we said earlier on, there's a nominal fee per hour for the gateway, and then you pay for whatever you leave out of the Azure network. important to note is that the gateway, or the VIP, the virtual IP address we talked about, that gateway can be stopped at any point in time. So if you choose, well, I don't want to have this up for this few days because I'm going to try to save myself some costs, then you can stop it. Okay, you can stop that gateway and obviously not be charged for the time that it's down. But you obviously remember that you've got domain controllers in there. They need to replicate. Okay, domain controllers need to replicate at least once in the tombstone lifecycle. Okay, at least once, and that's 180 days. So if you're going to shut down the gateway, make sure you bring it up at least 180 days. Once every 180 days. Okay. RODCs will likely prove more cost effective. Okay, there's a slide on that. We'll talk about that. Correctly defining your Active Directory sites, subnets, and site links. Very important. I can't stress this enough. Okay, because if you don't do this, then you'd have users from all, or you could potentially have users from various different parts of the world authenticating against this domain controller. Okay, the request comes in, and obviously in response to that request, you're going to have something going out. So again, it's going to cost you a bit more. Ensure that the cost between any on-premise site DC and cloud sites are appropriately dissuasive. So you want to try and dissuade usage of this site in Azure, unless absolutely necessary. Okay, so if you have a site somewhere in a remote location and the Azure site is actually the closest location to it, that's absolutely fine. But try to put it sort of second, third in the list in terms of costs. Okay, specify appropriate costs. Look at the network link speeds. Look at the geographic location of these resources. Excuse me. Okie doke. Ensure replication is scheduled, not notify driven. Okay, so there's a difference between Active Directory replication between sites and within a site. So I'll talk to you, excuse me, about this really quickly. And that within a site, we have something called intra-site replication. Within a site is intra-site replication. And we use a mechanism called change notification. Change notification means that when a domain controller has a change, it notifies its partner, "Hi, I have a change, come and get it." Okay. Between sites or inter-site replication, we use something called scheduled replication. Scheduled replication means I will queue the changes up and I will hold them until the schedule says I can let it go now, between 8 a.m. and 6 p.m., Monday to Friday. Okay, the difference between the two. So with change notification, whenever there's a change, you have replication. So you effectively, by default, out the box, that's 15 seconds. So every 15 seconds. So there are a large number of organizations that use change notification between sites, okay, which is absolutely fine if you have a good network and your low bandwidth usage, and you want faster replication. Use change notification. If you use that with a cloud domain controller, that means you're going to be replicating every 15 seconds potentially. Okay, so again, what's going in, what's coming out, costs for this domain controller, costs for the Azure subscription. So use scheduled replication instead of change notification. Okay, so you want to queue the changes up and then send them out. Okay, domain controllers, compression, okay, important. There's something else you can fine-tune, is that a domain controller by default uses something called express compress, and that's set to a value of 2 in the registry on all DCs. You can crank that up a bit to a value of 2, okay, which specifies MSZIP. MSZIP is more aggressive compression. As a result, the file that is sent across, or the data that is sent across, is smaller. Okay, so this is at the expense of the CPU. So not on the network. So you've got unlimited resources in Azure, right? So at the expense of the CPU, that's fine. If it's going to save me some cost. Okay, so I'd rather compress it more, reduce the size of the data that's being sent out, and then off you go. Okay. DCs replicate only the last state of the value. So slowing replication down saves costs if there's sufficient churn. Okay, so as we said, DCs work on a state base. So for example, if I have a user account and I change my telephone number 5 times in the last 10 minutes, only the last value of my telephone number will be replicated across. The first 4 are discarded. It's not relevant. I'm interested in the current state of my telephone number attribute. Use only RODC or read-only RODCs or read-writes. So, righty. The idea was posed that, right, so if Azure's going to charge me for traffic going out, what should I do? Should I use read-write or read-only? Okay. Read-only domain controllers were developed for environments that had low physical security. If you had a Dell Optiplex GX620 sat underneath the receptionist desk in the front that was running Active Directory, and when she was not at the desk, perhaps someone could pick up that machine and walk away with your Active Directory. So we developed read-only domain controllers. Okay, so what a read-only domain controller is obviously, as you know, is that no writes can originate on that DC. It can replicate in, but nothing can originate on it. So if I put a read-only DC out there in Azure, technically, that means that data can replicate in, but nothing comes out, right? Nothing comes out, no cost. Okay, but things to bear in mind is that if you've got applications in the cloud that need to write to the Active Directory, what happens when a write is sent to a read-only domain controller? It is forwarded to a read-write DC. Rightly so. Okay, so you're coming out, again, you're leaving the Windows Azure network. The other thing to mention with that as well is that if the application sends a write to a read-only DC, that write is forwarded to a read-write DC, the change is committed, okay, and the application is then obviously aware of this because it's the change is committed, but change that you've made has not replicated back to the read-only DC because now you've turned on the schedule. So when the application tries to access that value again on the read-only domain controller, it will fail. Okay, so things to bear in mind. Okay. High business impact, personally identifying information. Is that a concern? So if you do decide to go down the RODC route, okay, you have something called a read-only filtered attribute set or filtered attribute set. A read-only domain controller has the ability to define, or you can define, what's replicated to it. I don't want my home address or I don't want my job description attribute replicated to that DC or the read-only DC. So I can exclude that from the read-only filtered attribute set. So filtered attribute set is a group or list of attributes that you can filter out. I don't want this to go to a read-only DC. For example, my password or my home address, my job description. Okay, so if you do decide to go down that route, that's an option you can think about. Okay, so RODCs introduce another layer of complexity, really. Think about it before you deploy it. If it's purely for authentication, again, this is, I wish I had the answer for you, but I don't. If it's purely for the application, then perhaps you need to review that. If it's purely for users and it's not going to be used by an application, then you could quite easily perhaps get away with a read-only domain controller. All depends on what the requirements are. Finally, RODCs never replicate anything outbound. Okay, so as we said, if you have any changes, they replicate into the DC, but nothing leaves the RODC, so saving you costs. Global catalog or not, how many of you have multiple domain forests? Show of hands. It's the same three people. Four, five. Okay. So in a multiple domain environment, a global catalog is very important. Okay. The reason why it's important is because of authentication, universal groups. So back in Windows 2000, when we introduced the native mode domain, when all domain controllers were running Windows 2000, we introduced the universal group. Ooh, and we got all excited about it and put everything in there. Universal group membership is stored on global catalog servers. Okay, this is replicated throughout the forest. When a user authenticates or attempts to log in, his universal group membership is checked, irrespective if you're a member or not. So regardless, your universal group membership is checked. Okay, in order for that to be checked, I need a global catalog server. If I don't deploy a GC in the cloud or in my Azure site, I'm going to be leaving the network and coming back on site again. Okay, so bear that in mind. Trust or replicate. Trust or replicate. Okay, so the choices. Do I add replica DCs in the cloud or build a new forest and create a trust? Okay, so we talked about this briefly earlier on. Is that this will depend on your requirements. Okay, so there's no black and white answer for this, unfortunately. But as we said, if you want something isolated, you probably look at a new forest. If you do deploy a new forest, is it Kerberos or federated? Okay, do I use interforest trust between the two? Or do I federate? Motivators for making this choice. Okay, compatibility. Is the application federation aware? Okay, it's a case of like, I like you, but I'm not ready to share my toothbrush with you. With a trust, it's kind of like all or nothing. But with federation, you could quite easily define exactly what your requirements are. So with federation, it's the originator's DC will actually authenticate them. Okay, so look at whether or not the application is federation aware. If it's not aware, then that throws that out the window. So effectively, you have to look at a trust. Okay, if you do decide to go on the trust, security, we've got features with Interforest Trust, selective authentication and SID filtering. Okay, selective authentication is a feature that exists on Interforest Trusts by default, and what this means is that before the KDC creates a TGT, or service ticket rather, before the KDC creates a service ticket, it will check the object that you are authenticating against. So, for example, if I need access to File Server 1, the KDC will search for the computer account for File Server 1 and check on that account if you are allowed to authenticate to it. Okay, it's selective. If the answer on that account says no, then the request is thrown out. It will not authenticate you. So this is between forests. So if you have forest A and forest B, and you want users in forest A to authenticate only against two file servers, you can go in and configure selective authentication. Okay. You have SID filtering. SID filtering, two forests, forest A, forest B. If a malicious user is trying to elevate his or her permissions, I could take an NT token from the forest A, for example, and I can inject my SID into it. My SID in my environment has obviously no relevance, but in the other forest, it might have a domain admin credential. So all I need to do is get this NT token across the wire, and who am I when I reach your front door? I'm an administrator. Okay. So SID filtering, what that is between two forests. When the authentication request comes in, I will check my filter. If I have a SID X, Y, and Z, filter that out. Don't include that. So immediately, if I do try to inject that into the token and send it across, my filter will say, "Oh, I'm going to throw this out," quite effectively. Okay, and authentication fails, or the request is denied. Compliancy, privacy, high business impact, as we talked about, personal identifier information. Costs, replicate more or generate outbound traffic as a result of authentication and query load. Again, you know, there's no black and white answer for this. It will all depend on what the business or the application or service requirements are. IP addressing. Use dynamic IP addresses that are issued by Windows Azure. Please do not use static IP addresses. I said earlier on we're going to talk about this. If you do decide to use a manually assigned IP address, what happened was a VM came up, we got the IP address that was assigned by the DHCP server, and we thought, I know what the IP address is now. I will go and manually put it in. Okay, it did work until the lease expired. And then that IP address was given to another machine. And then we lost connectivity to the DC. So that won't work. Okay. So use dynamically assigned IP addresses that are issued by Windows Azure. Obviously, as we said, you need the Windows Azure Virtual Network for that. When Azure VM leases an address, it is rootable for the period of the lease, as I said to you. This IP address is owned by the box for the duration of it. Traditional on-premises best practices. I put this in because traditionally we said for domain controllers, it's important, static IP addresses. Okay, even when you try to make some changes to it, it comes up and says, this domain controller has a dynamically assigned IP address. Ooh, it's a bad thing. Okay, so this is contradicted to what you're traditionally used to doing. Okay, name resolution. Okay, so Windows Azure has a very basic name resolution mechanism. Okay, so it does basic A name resolution. For domain controllers, we have specific requirements, SRV records, CNAMEs, pointer records. These records cannot be updated on a Windows Azure DNS server. Also, the Windows Azure DNS server does not support dynamic DNS. Okay, so that's very important. That's not going to. We have serious issues if that's the case. DNS is critical to Active Directory, so make sure it's important. If you deploy a DC out there, install the DNS service on it and make it a DNS server, okay, so that you have an infrastructure out there. Okie doke. IP addressing and name resolution summary. This is, I put this together as just a sort of guideline or reference. Okay. Deploy a Windows Azure Virtual Network, as we said. Use the DHCP leases, which is fine. Install and configure DNS on all your domain controllers. Okay. Number four, preferred DNS server, on-premises IP address. Okay, you might think, why on earth should I do that? Simple answer is because we don't know what the IP address is of the new DC. Okay, so when it comes up, we don't know what the IP address is. When it comes up, we know what it is. But at the time of build, we don't know what the IP address is. So we can't really specify that. Okay, so important. Specify an on-premise IP address. Once the DC is built, then you can obviously go in and change that later on and look at what suits your environment best. Geo-distributed cloud-hosted domain controllers. Okay. Azure offers an attractive option for geo-distribution of DC. So we talked about that little site that's in some remote location that doesn't have any IT presence. So at the moment, we've got different Azure data centers. Okay. You can look at, obviously, the data center that's closest to your site and deploy a domain controller out there. Important note, I put this under the diagram on there, is that connectivity between virtual networks within Azure does not exist at the moment. So this is something that has been mentioned. If you would like to have the feature, I urge you to let us know, because this is all based on how much noise there is. Okay, so if you want the feature, I think it's fantastic. If you could get two DCs to replicate in the cloud, in your environment, that's brilliant. They wouldn't have to come out to the hub site. Okay, so you could go read-write DCs all over the place. Okay, so this is all based on the amount of noise that you make. So if you want the feature, please, obviously, give us a thumbs up for it. Multiple virtual networks are isolated from one another. There is no VPN tunneling. All replication would route through or bounce off CORP. So as we said, again, from your Azure network, out. Okay, and then from your hub, back into Azure. So it could be better, I think. Okie doke. Summary review. Okay, summary review. Is it safe to virtualize DCs? Absolutely. Go forth and virtualize. However, bear in mind the best practices and caveats that come along with that. Disable sync time from host. Okay. Treat it as a physical DC. Full server backup. System state backup. Okay. Make sure that the VHD files are in a secure location. Not exposed to people that don't need access to it, because that's your Active Directory on that VHD file. Placement of the database. Use data disks, okay, instead of OS disks, as we said. When you build a VM, automatically OS disk, which is rightly so, because the OS is built on an OS disk. Add in a second disk. If you choose the defaults, next, finish, you're going to install that on a OS disk. So install a second disk, data disk, and configure the Active Directory to be stored on there. Optimizing your deployment for traffic and costs. Important again. Configure your sites, subnets, and site links optimally. Look at the site costs. Okay. Make sure the subnets are linked into the sites to dissuade usage of these Windows Azure sites. Read-only DCs, read writes again. If you have an application that needs to write to the AD in the cloud, then maybe that's not such a good idea for read-write DCs. But if it's purely used for authentication for a remote site, then maybe you could. Okay. Look at the pros and cons. Global catalog or not, only a question in a multi-domain forest. If you're running a single domain forest, absolutely make all DCs GCs and no issues. Trust or replicate, balance the requirements, resiliency, costs. Is the application federation aware? Key point. If it's not, obviously that's out the window. IP addressing, use dynamic IP addresses. Use or supplement your existing DNS service. Okay. As we said, Windows Azure DNS is very basic, so it's A records only. Geo-distributed domain controllers, note that virtual machines on separate virtual networks are isolated from each other. Okay, so they can't replicate. So you've got two DCs, one in Azure US and one in Azure Far East. They can't replicate. They're going to bounce off Copenhagen, for example, or your head office, and then off the other way. Okay, so at the present, that is not the case. Okay, that's me done. Unfortunately, there isn't enough time for demo. I think we're just 1 minute over. I would like to ask you if you could please fill in the feedback. We are a feedback-driven company. I work as a field engineer. As I said, if you want to see more notes from the field, if you want to see more of what's happening around, let us know, please. It's your feedback that's important. It's your feedback that drives these events. So let's hear from you. The process has been simplified. You could send a text message to 1919 with a session DA304, and then obviously the scales. If you felt that this was a good session, if you felt it was absolutely worthless, you've gained nothing from it, please, we'd like to know. Okay. And thank you very much for your time. You've been fantastic.